I'm in a rowboat on the lake in Central Park. Fortunately, I'm not rowing the boat. I'm still in college, but soon I won't be. Soon I'll be living here in New York City. I look up at all the buildings surrounding the park, and it crosses my mind that except for the man rowing the boat, I don't know anyone in New York City, and I barely know the man in the boat. I wonder if I'm going to end up being one of those people you read about in newspapers who lives in New York and never meets anyone and eventually dies, and no one even notices until days later when the smell drifts out into the hallway. I vow that someday I will know someone in New York City. I'm going to be a newspaper reporter forever. It's 1963. I've written a piece for a parody of the New York Post during a long newspaper strike. The editors of the Post are upset about the parody, but the publisher of the Post is amused. If they can parody the Post, they can write for it, she says, hire them. When the strike ends, I'm given a one-week tryout at the Post. The city room is dusty, dingy, and dark. The desks are dilapidated and falling apart. It smells terrible. There aren't enough phones. The city editor sends me to the Coney Island Aquarium to cover the story of two hooded seals who've been brought together to mate but have refused to have anything to do with each other. I write a story. I think it's funny. I turn it in. I hear laughter from the city desk. They think it's funny, too. I am hired permanently. I have never been happier. I have achieved my life's ambition, and I am 22 years old. I may not be a newspaper reporter forever. One night, I go to a bar near the Post with one of my fellow reporters and the managing editor. It's been raining. After quite a few drinks, the managing editor invites us to his home in Brooklyn Heights. When we get there, he tells me to stand on the stoop in front of the house. There's an awning over one of the windows. As I step into position, he lowers the awning, and about 10 gallons of water drench me from head to toe. He thinks this is hilarious. My life changes. I write a magazine article about having small breasts. I am now a writer. What my mother said. I now believe that what my mother meant when she said everything is copy is this. When you slip on a banana peel, people laugh at you. But when you tell people you slipped on a banana peel, it's your laugh. So you become the hero rather than the victim of the joke. I think that's what she meant. On the other hand, she may merely have meant everything is copy. When she was in the hospital dying, she said to me, "You're a reporter, Nora. Take notes." It seems to me this is not quite the same as everything is copy. My mother died of cirrhosis, but the immediate cause of her death was an overdose of sleeping pills administered by my father. At the time, this didn't seem to me to fall under the rubric of everything is copy, although it did to my sister Amy, and she put it into a novel. Who can blame her? How she died, my version. My mother is in the hospital. Every day my father calls and says, "This is it, they're pulling the plug." But there is no plug. My mother comes home. Several days pass. One day my father says, "I'm going to give the nurse the night off." Late that night he calls me to tell me my mother has died. The funeral home has already come and taken away her body. I go to their apartment. It's 4 in the morning. I sit with my father for a while, and then we both decide to take a nap before the next day begins. My father reaches into the pocket of his bathrobe and pulls out a bottle of sleeping pills. "The doctor gave me these in case I was having trouble sleeping," he says. "Flush them down the toilet." I go into the bathroom and flush them down the toilet. The next morning, when my sisters arrive, I tell them about the pills. My sister Amy says to me, "Did you count the pills?" "No," I say. "Duh," she says. I was married to him for 6 years. My first husband is a perfectly nice person, although he's pathologically attached to his cats. It's 1972, the height of the women's movement, and everyone is getting a divorce, even people whose husbands don't have pathological attachments to their cats. My husband is planning for us to take a photo safari through Africa, and I say to him, "I can't go on this trip." "Why not?" he says. "Because it's very expensive, and we're probably going to split up, and I'll feel horribly guilty that you spent all this money taking me to Africa." "Don't be crazy," my husband says. "I love you, and you love me, and we're not getting a divorce, and even if we do, you're the only person I want to go to Africa with. We're going." So we go to Africa. It's a wonderful trip. When we come back, I tell my husband that I want a divorce. "But I took you to Africa," he says. You can't make this stuff up. I'm working on a magazine story about a woman who was fired from her job as president of Bennington College. I have read a story about her in the New York Times that says she's been fired, along with her husband, the vice president of Bennington, because of her brave stand against tenure. I suspect her firing has nothing to do with her brave stand against tenure, although I don't have a clue what the real reason is. I go to Bennington and discover that she has in fact been fired because she's been having an affair with a professor at Bennington, that they taught a class in Hawthorne together, and that they both wore matching T-shirts in class with scarlet A's on them. What's more, I learn that the faculty hated her from the very beginning because she had a party for them and served lukewarm lasagna and unthawed Sara Lee banana cake. I can't get over this aspect of journalism. I can't believe how real life never lets you down. I can't understand why anyone would write fiction when what actually happens is so amazing. Everything is copy. I'm 7 months pregnant with my second child, and I've just discovered that my second husband is in love with someone else. She, too, is married. Her husband telephones me. He's the British ambassador to the United States. I'm not kidding. He happens to be the kind of person who tends to see almost everything in global terms. He suggests lunch. We meet outside a Chinese restaurant on Connecticut Avenue and fall into each other's arms weeping. "Oh, Peter," I say to him, "isn't it awful?" "It's awful," he says. "What's happening to this country?" I'm crying hysterically, but I'm thinking, someday, this will be a funny story. I was married to him for 2 years and 8 months. I fly to New York to see my shrink. I walk into her office and burst into tears. I tell her what my husband has done to me. I tell her my heart is broken. I tell her I'm a total mess and I will never be the same. I can't stop crying. She looks at me and says, "You have to understand something. You were going to leave him eventually." On the other hand, perhaps you can make this stuff up. So I write a novel. I change my first husband's cats into hamsters, and I change the British ambassador into an undersecretary of state, and I give my second husband a beard. One of the saddest things about divorce. My sister Delia says this, and it's true. When we were growing up, we used to love to hear the story of how our parents met and fell in love and eloped one summer when they were both camp counselors. It was so much a part of our lives, a song sung again and again, and no matter what happened, No matter how awful things became between the two of them, we always knew that our parents had once been madly in love. But in a divorce, you never tell your children that you were once madly in love with their father because it would be too confusing. And then, after a while, you can't even remember whether you were. A man and a woman live in a house on a deserted peninsula. Alice Arlen and I have written a script for the movie Silkwood. It's based on the true story of Karen Silkwood, who worked at a plutonium plant in Oklahoma. She died in a mysterious automobile accident while on her way to meet a New York Times reporter to talk about conditions in the plant. Mike Nichols is going to direct it. He was supposed to direct a Broadway musical instead, but it all fell through because he was betrayed by a close friend who was involved with the show. We will call this close friend Jane Doe for the purposes of this story. So, we all start to work together on the next draft of the script. And Mike keeps suggesting scenes for the movie that involve Karen Silkwood's being betrayed by a close woman friend. He has a million ideas along these lines, none of which really bears any resemblance to what happened to Karen Silkwood, but all of which bear a resemblance to what happened between Mike and his friend Jane. I finally say, Mike, Jane Doe did not kill Karen Silkwood. Yes, Mike says, I see what you're saying. It's the Peninsula story. And he tells us the Peninsula story. A man and a woman live in a house on a deserted peninsula. The man's mother comes to stay with them, and the man goes off on a business trip. The woman takes the ferry to the mainland and goes to see her lover. They make love. When they finish, she realizes it's late, and she gets up, dresses, and rushes to catch the last ferry home. But she misses the boat. She pleads with the ferry boat captain. He tells her he will take her back to the peninsula if she gives him 6 times the normal fare. But she doesn't have the money. So she's forced to walk home, and on the way, she's raped and killed by a stranger. And the question is, who is responsible for her death, and in what order? The woman, the man, the mother, the ferry boat captain, the lover, or the rapist? The question is a Rorschach, Mike says, and if you ask your friends to answer it, they will all answer differently. This is another light bulb moment. This one marks the end of my love affair with journalism and the beginning of my understanding that just about everything is a story. Or, as E.L. Doctorow once wrote, far more succinctly, I am led to the proposition that there is no fiction or nonfiction as we commonly understand the distinction. There is only narrative. From my script for When Harry Met Sally. Harry, why don't you tell me the story of your life? Sally, the story of my life? Harry, we've got 18 hours to kill before we hit New York. Sally, the story of my life isn't even going to get us out of Chicago. I mean, nothing's happened to me yet. That's why I'm going to New York. Harry, so something can happen to you? Sally, yes. Harry, like what? Sally, like I'm going to journalism school to become a reporter. Harry, so you can write about things that happen to other people. Sally, that's one way to look at it. Harry, suppose nothing happens to you. Suppose you live there your whole life and nothing happens. You never meet anyone. You never become anything. And finally you die one of those New York deaths where nobody notices for 2 weeks until the smell drifts out into the hallway. A guy walks into a restaurant. I'm having dinner at a restaurant with friends. A man I know comes over to the table. He's a famously nice guy. His marriage broke up at about the same time mine did. He says, How can I find you? We can't do everything. I'm sitting in a small screening room waiting for a movie to begin. The room fills up. There aren't enough seats. People are bunching up in the aisles and looking around helplessly. I'm next to my friend Bob Gottlieb watching all this. The director of the movie decides to solve the problem by asking all the children at the screening to share seats. I watch in mounting frustration. Finally, I say to Bob, "It's really very simple. Someone should just go get some folding chairs and set them up in the aisles." Bob looks at me. "Nora," he says, "we can't do everything." My brain clears in an amazing way. "Nora, we can't do everything. I have been given the secret of life, although it's probably a little late." And, by the way, the other day I bought a red coat on sale, but I haven't worn it yet. The Lost Strudel, or Le Strudel Perdu. Food vanishes. I don't mean food as habit, food as memory, food as biography, food as metaphor, food as regret, food as love, or food as in those famous Madeleines people like me are constantly referring to as if they've read Proust, which in most cases they haven't. I mean food as food. Food vanishes. I'm talking about cabbage strudel, which vanished from Manhattan in about 1982, and which I've been searching for these last 23 years. Cabbage strudel is on a long list of things I love to eat that used to be here and then weren't, starting with frozen custard. This delectable treat vanished when I was 5 years old when my family moved to California, and my life has been a series of little heartbreaks ever since. The cabbage strudel I'm writing about was sold at an extremely modest Hungarian bakery on 3rd Avenue called Mrs. Herbst. I initially tasted it in 1968, and I don't want to be sentimental about it, except to say that it's almost the only thing I remember about my first marriage. Cabbage strudel looks like apple strudel, but it's not a dessert. It's more like a pirozhok, the meat-stuffed puff pastry that was a specialty of the Russian tea room, which also vanished. It's served with soup or with a main course like pot roast or roast pheasant. Not that I've ever made roast pheasant, but no question cabbage strudel would be delicious with it. It has a buttery, flaky, crispy strudel crust made of phyllo, the art of which I plan to master in my next life, when I will also read Proust past the first chapter. With a moist filling of sautéed cabbage that's simultaneously sweet, savory, and completely unexpected, like all good things. Once upon a time, I ate quite a lot of cabbage strudel, and then I sort of forgot about it for a while. I think of that period as my own personal temps perdu. And I feel bad about it for many reasons, not the least of which is that it never crossed my mind that my beloved cabbage strudel would not be waiting for me when I was ready to remember it again. This is New York, of course. The city throws curves. Rents go up, people get old, and their children no longer want to run the store. So you find yourself on the east side looking for Mrs. Herbst's Hungarian bakery, which was there, has always been there, is a landmark, for God's sake, a fixture of the neighborhood, practically a defining moment of New York life, and it's vanished, and no one even bothered to tell you. It's sad. Not as sad as things that are truly sad, I'll grant you that, but sad nonetheless. On the other hand, the full blow is mitigated somewhat by the possibility that somewhere, somehow, you'll find the lost strudel or be able to replicate it. And so, at first, you hope. And then you hope against hope. And then finally, you lose hope. And there you have it, the three stages of grief when it comes to lost food. The strudel was not to be found. I spent hours on the internet looking for a recipe, but nothing seemed like the exact cabbage strudel I'd lost. At a cocktail party, I lunged pathetically at a man named Peter Herbst, a magazine editor who my husband had led me to believe was a relative of the Herbst strudel dynasty, but he turned out not to be. I spoke to George Lang, the famous Hungarian restaurateur, who was kind enough to send me a recipe for cabbage strudel, but I tried making it and it just wasn't the same. The truth is, most of the genuinely tragic episodes of lost food are things that are somewhat outside the reach of a home cook, even a home cook like me who has been known to overreach from time to time. About 2 years ago, when I had landed in what I thought was the slough of despond where cabbage strudel was concerned and could not possibly sink lower, my heart was broken once again. The food writer Ed Levine told me that the strudel I was looking for was available by special order only at a Hungarian bakery named Andres in Rego Park, Queens. Ed hadn't actually sampled it himself, but he assured me that all I had to do was call Andre and he'd make it for me. I couldn't believe it. I immediately called Andre. I dropped Ed Levine's name so hard you could hear it in New Jersey. I said that Ed had told me Andre would make cabbage strudel if I ordered it, so I was calling to order it. I was prepared to order a gross of cabbage strudels if necessary. Guess what? Andre didn't care about Ed Levine or me. He refused to make it. He said he was way too busy making other kinds of strudel. So that was that. But it wasn't. This week, I heard from Ed Levine again. He emailed to say that Andre's Hungarian bakery had opened a branch on 2nd Avenue and 85th Street. It was selling cabbage strudel over the counter. You didn't even have to order it. It was sitting right there in the bakery case. Ed Levine had eaten a piece of it. "Now I understand why you've been raving about cabbage strudel all this time," he wrote. The next day, my husband and I walked over to Andre's. It was a beautiful winter day in New York, or my idea of a beautiful winter day in that you barely needed a coat. We found the bakery, which is also a cafe, went inside, and ordered the cabbage strudel heated up. It arrived. I lifted a forkful to my lips and tasted it. Now, I'm not going to tell you that, like Proust tasting the Madeleine, I shuddered. Nor am I going to report that, quote, the vicissitudes of life had become indifferent to me, its disasters innocuous, its brevity illusory, unquote. That would take way more than cabbage strudel. But Andre's cabbage strudel was divine. Crisp but moist, savory but sweet, buttery beyond imagining. It wasn't completely identical to Mrs. Herbst's, but it was absolutely as delicious, if not more so. Tasting it again was like being able to turn back the clock, like having the consequences of a mistake erased. It was better than getting a blouse back that the dry cleaners had lost, or a cell phone return that had been left in a taxi. It was a validation of never giving up and of hope springing eternal. It was many things. It was all things. It was nothing at all. But mostly, it was cabbage strudel. On Rapture. I've just surfaced from spending several days in a state of rapture with a book. I loved this book. I loved every second of it. I was transported into its world. I was reminded of all sorts of things in my own life. I was in anguish over the fate of its characters. I felt alive and engaged and positively brilliant, bursting with ideas, brimming with memories of other books I've loved. I composed a dozen imaginary letters to the author, letters I'll never write, much less send. I wrote letters of praise. I wrote letters relating entirely inappropriate personal information about my own experiences with the author's subject matter. I even wrote a letter of recrimination when one of the characters died and I was grief-stricken. But mostly I wrote letters of gratitude. The state of rapture I experience when I read a wonderful book is one of the main reasons I read, but it doesn't happen every time, or even every other time, and when it does happen, I'm truly beside myself. When I was a child, nearly every book I read sent me into rapture. Can I be romanticizing my early reading experiences? I don't think so. I can tick off so many books that I read and reread when I was growing up, foremost among them the Oz books, which obsessed me, but so many others that were favorites in the most compelling way. I wanted so badly to be Jane Banks, growing up in London with Mary Poppins for a nanny, or Homer Price growing up in Centerburg with an uncle who owned a donut machine that wouldn't stop making donuts. Little Sarah Crewe in Frances Hodgson Burnett's classic A Little Princess was my alter ego, not in any real way, you understand. She was a much better behaved child than I ever was. But I was so entranced by the story of the little rich girl who was sent up to the garret to be the scullery maid at the fancy boarding school where she'd been a pampered student before her father died. Oh, how I wanted to be an orphan. I read the nun's story, and oh, how I wanted to be a nun. I wanted to be shipwrecked on a desert island and stranded in Krakatoa. I wanted to be Ozma and Joe March and Anne Frank and Nancy Drew and Eloise and Anne of Green Gables. And in my imagination, at least, I could be. I did most of my reading as a child on my bed or on a rattan sofa in the sunroom of the house I grew up in. Here's a strange thing. Whenever I read a book I love, I start to remember all the other books that have sent me into rapture, and I can remember where I was living and the couch I was sitting on when I read them. After college, living in Greenwich Village, I sat on my brand new wide whale corduroy couch and read The Golden Notebook by Doris Lessing, the extraordinary novel that changed my life and the lives of so many other young women in the 1960s. I have the paperback copy I read at the time, and it's dog-eared, epiphany after epiphany marked so that I could easily refer back to them. Does anyone read The Golden Notebook nowadays? I don't know. But at the time, just before the second stage of the women's movement burst into being, I was electrified by Lessing's heroine Anna and her struggle to become a free woman. Work, friendship, love, sex, politics, psychoanalysis, writing, all the things that preoccupied me were Lessing subjects, and I can remember how many times I put the book down, reeling from its brilliance and insights. Cut to a few years later. The couch is covered with purple slipcovers, and I'm reading for pure pleasure. It's The Godfather by Mario Puzo, a divine book that sweeps me off into a wave of romantic delirium. I want to be a mafioso. No, that's not quite right. Okay, then I want to be a mafioso's wife. A few years later, I'm divorced. No surprise there. The couch and I have moved to a dark apartment in the West 50s. It's a summer weekend. I have nothing whatsoever to do. And I should be lonely, but I'm not. I'm reading the collected works of Raymond Chandler. 6 years later, another divorce. For weeks, I've been unable to focus, to settle down, to read anything at all. A friend I'm staying with gives me the bound galleys of Smiley's People. I sink into the bed in the guest bedroom and happily surrender to John le Carré. I love John le Carré, but I'm even more in love with his hero, George Smiley, the spy with the broken heart. I want George Smiley to get over his broken heart. I want him to get over his horrible ex-wife who betrayed him. I want George Smiley to fall in love. I want George Smiley to fall in love with me. George Smiley, come to think of it, is exactly the sort of person I ought to marry and never do. I make a mental note to write John Le Carré a letter giving him the benefit of my wisdom on this score. But meanwhile, my purple couch is lost in the divorce, and I buy a new couch. A wonderful squishy thing covered with a warm, cozy fabric, with arms you can lie back on and cushions you can sink into depending on whether you want to read sitting up or lying down. On it, I read most of Anthony Trollope and all of Edith Wharton, both of whom are dead and can't be written to. Too bad. I'd like to tell them their books are as contemporary as they were when they were written. I read all of Jane Austen, 6 novels back to back, and spend days blissfully worrying over whether the lovers in each book will ever overcome the misunderstandings, objections, misapprehensions, character flaws, class distinctions, and all the other obstacles to love. I read these novels in a state of suspense so intense that you would never guess I have read them all at least 10 times before. And then, finally, one day, I read the novel that is probably the most rapture-inducing book of my adult life. On a chaise longue at the beach, on a beautiful summer day, I open Wilkie Collins' masterpiece, The Woman in White, probably the first great work of mystery fiction ever written, although that description hardly does it justice. I am instantly lost to the world. Days pass as I savor every word. Each minute I spend away from the book pretending to be interested in everyday life is a misery. How could I have waited so long to read this book? When can I get back to it? Halfway through, I return to New York to work, to finish a movie, and I sit in the mix studio unable to focus on anything but whether my favorite character in the book will survive. I will not be able to bear it if anything bad happens to my beloved Marion Holcomb. Every so often, I look up from the book and see a room full of people waiting for me to make a decision about whether the music is too soft or the thunder is too loud, and I can't believe they don't understand that what I'm doing is much more important. I'm reading the most wonderful book. There's something called the rapture of the deep, and it refers to what happens when a deep sea diver spends too much time at the bottom of the ocean and can't tell which way is up. When he surfaces, he's liable to have a condition called the bends, where the body can't adapt to the oxygen levels in the atmosphere. All this happens to me when I surface from a great book. The book I've currently surfaced from, the one I mentioned at the beginning, is called The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. It's about two men who create comic book characters, but it's also about how artists create fantastic and magical things from the events of everyday life. At one point in the book, there's a room full of moths, and then a few pages later, there's a huge Luna moth sitting in a maple tree in Union Square Park. And all of this is reinvented a few pages later as a female comic book heroine named Luna Moth. The moment where the image turns from ordinary to fantastic was so magical that I had to put down the book. I was dazed by the playfulness of the author and his ability to do something so difficult with such apparent ease. Chabon's novel takes place in New York City in the 40s, and though I finished reading it more than a week ago, I'm still there. I'm smoking Camels, and Salvador Dali is at a party in the next room. Eventually, I'll have to start breathing the air in today's New York again. But on the other hand, perhaps I won't have to. I'll find another book I love and disappear into it. Wish me luck. What I Wish I'd Known. People have only one way to be. Buy, don't rent. Never marry a man you wouldn't want to be divorced from. Don't cover a couch with anything that isn't more or less beige. Don't buy anything that is 100% wool, even if it seems to be very soft and not particularly itchy when you try it on in the store. You can't be friends with people who call after 11 p.m. Block everyone on your instant mail. The world's greatest babysitter burns out after 2.5 years. You never know. The last 4 years of psychoanalysis are a waste of money. The plane is not going to crash. Anything you think is wrong with your body at the age of 35, you will be nostalgic for at the age of 45. At the age of 55, you will get a saggy roll just above your waist, even if you are painfully thin. This saggy roll just above your waist will be especially visible from the back and will force you to reevaluate half the clothes in your closet, especially the white shirts. Write everything down. Keep a journal. Take more pictures. The empty nest is underrated. You can order more than one dessert. You can't own too many black turtleneck sweaters. If the shoe doesn't fit in the shoe store, it's never going to fit. When your children are teenagers, it's important to have a dog so that someone in the house is happy to see you. Back up your files. Over-insure everything. Whenever someone says the words, "Our friendship is more important than this," watch out, because it almost never is. There's no point in making pie crust from scratch. The reason you're waking up in the middle of the night is the second glass of wine. The minute you decide to get divorced, go see a lawyer and file the papers. Overtip. Never let them know. If only 1/3 of your clothes are mistakes, you're ahead of the game. If friends ask you to be their child's guardian in case they die in a plane crash, you can say no. There are no secrets. Considering the alternative. When I turned 60, I had a big birthday party in Las Vegas, which happens to be one of my top 5 places. We spent the weekend eating and drinking and gambling and having fun. One of my friends threw 12 passes at the craps table, and we all made some money and screamed and yelled, and I went to bed deliriously happy. The spell lasted for several days, and as a result, I managed to avoid thinking about what it all meant. Denial has been a way of life for me for many years. I actually believe in denial. It seemed to me that the only way to deal with a birthday of this sort was to do everything possible to push it from my mind. Nothing else about me is better than it was at 50 or 40 or 30, but I definitely have the best haircut I've ever had. I like my new apartment, and as the expression goes, consider the alternative. I have been 60 for 4 years now, and by the time you read this, I will probably have been 60 for 5. I survived turning 60. I was not thrilled to turn 61. I was less thrilled to turn 62. I didn't much like being 63. I loathed being 64. And I will hate being 65. I don't let on about such things in person. In person, I am cheerful and Pollyanna-ish. But the honest truth is that it's sad to be over 60. The long shadows are everywhere. Friends dying and battling illness. A miasma of melancholy hangs there, forcing you to deal with the fact that your life however happy and successful, has been full of disappointments and mistakes, little ones and big ones. There are dreams that are never quite going to come true, ambitions that will never quite be realized. There are, in short, regrets. Edith Piaf was famous for singing a song called Non, je ne regrette rien. It's a good song. I know what she meant. I can get into it. I can make a case that I regret nothing. After all, most of my mistakes turned out to be things I survived or turned into funny stories or on occasion even made money from. But the truth is that je regrette beaucoup. There are all sorts of books written for older women. They are, as far as I can tell, uniformly upbeat and full of bromides and homilies about how pleasant life can be once one is free from all the nagging obligations of children, monthly periods, and in some cases full-time jobs. I find these books utterly useless, just as I found all the books I once read about menopause utterly useless. Why do people write books that say it's better to be older than to be younger? It's not better. Even if you have all your marbles, you're constantly reaching for the name of the person you met the day before yesterday. Even if you're in great shape, you can't chop an onion the way you used to, and you can't ride a bicycle several miles without becoming a candidate for traction. If you work, you're surrounded by young people who are plugged into the marketplace, the demographic, the zeitgeist. They want your job, and someday soon, they're going to get it. If you're fortunate enough to be in a sexual relationship, you're not going to have the sex you once had. Plus, you can't wear a bikini. Oh, how I regret not having worn a bikini for the entire year I was 26. If anyone young is listening to this, go right this minute, put on a bikini, and don't take it off until you're 34. A magazine editor called me the other day, an editor who, like me, is over 60. Her magazine was going to do an issue on age, and she wanted me to write something for it. We began to talk about the subject, and she said, "You know what drives me nuts? Why do women our age say, 'In my day'? This is our day." But it isn't our day. It's their day. We're just hanging on. We can't wear tank tops. We have no idea who 50 Cent is. And we don't know how to use almost any of the functions on our cell phones. If we hit the wrong button on the remote control and the television screen turns to snow, we have no idea how to get the television set back to where it was in the first place. This is the true nightmare of the empty nest. Your children are gone, and they were the only people in the house who knew how to use the remote control. Technology is a bitch. I can no longer even figure out how to get the buttons on the car radio to play my favorite stations. The gears on my bicycle mystify me, on my bicycle. And thank God no one has given me a digital wristwatch. In fact, if any of my friends is listening to this, please don't ever give me a digital anything. Just the other day, I went shopping at a store in Los Angeles that happens to stock jeans that actually come all the way up to my waist. And I was stunned to discover that the customer just before me was Nancy Reagan. That's how old I am. Nancy Reagan and I shop in the same store. Anyway, I said to this editor, "You're wrong. You are so wrong. This is not our day. This is their day." But she was undaunted. She said to me, "Well, then, I have another idea. Why don't you write about age shame?" I said to her, "Get someone who is only 50 to write about age shame. I am way past age shame, if I ever had it. I'm just happy to be here at all." Anyway, the point is, I don't know why so much nonsense about age is written, although I can certainly understand that no one really wants to read anything that says aging sucks. We are a generation that has learned to believe we can do something about almost everything. We are active. Hell, we are proactive. We are positive thinkers. We have the power. We will take any suggestion seriously. If a pill will help, we will take it. If being in the zone will help, we will enter the zone. When we hear about the latest ludicrously expensive face cream that is alleged to turn back the clock, we will go out and buy it, even though we know that the last 5 face creams we fell for were completely ineffectual. We will do crossword puzzles to ward off Alzheimer's and eat 6 almonds a day to ward off cancer. We will scan ourselves to find whatever can be nipped in the bud. We are in control. Behind the wheel, on the cutting edge, we make lists. We seek out the options. We surf the net. But there are some things that are absolutely, definitively, entirely uncontrollable. I am dancing around the D word, but I don't mean to be coy. When you cross into your 60s, your odds of dying, or of merely getting horribly sick on the way to dying, spike. Death is a sniper. It strikes people you love, people you like, people you know. It's everywhere. You could be next. But then you turn out not to be. But then again, you could be. And meanwhile, your friends die, and you're left not just bereft, not just grieving, not just guilty, but utterly helpless. There is nothing you can do, nothing. Everybody dies. What is the answer, Gertrude Stein asked Alice B. Toklas as Stein was dying. There was no reply. In that case, what is the question, Stein asked. Well, exactly. Well, not quite exactly. Here are some questions I'm constantly noodling over. Do you splurge or do you hoard? Do you live every day as if it's your last? Or do you save your money on the chance that you'll live 20 more years? Is life too short or is it going to be too long? Do you work as hard as you can or do you slow down to smell the roses? And where do carbohydrates fit into all this? Are we really going to have to spend our last years avoiding bread, especially now that bread in America is so unbelievably delicious? And what about chocolate? There's a question for you, Gertrude Stein. What about chocolate? My friend Judy died last year. She was the person I told everything to. She was my best friend, my extra sister, my true mother, sometimes even my daughter. She was all these things. And one day she called up to say the weirdest thing has happened. There's a lump on my tongue. Less than a year later, she was dead. She was 66 years old. She had no interest in dying right to the end. She died horribly. And now she's gone. I think of her every day, sometimes 6 or 7 times a day. This is the weekend she and I usually went to the Spring Garden and Antique Show in Bridgehampton together. The fire screen in the next room is something she spotted in a corner of that antique show. And above the fireplace is a poster of a seagull that she gave me only 2 summers ago. It's June now. This is the month one or the other of us would make the cornbread pudding, a ridiculous recipe we both loved that's made with cornbread mix and canned creamed corn. She made hers with sour cream, and I made mine without. Hi, hun, she would say when she called. Hi, doll. Hello, my darling. I don't think she ever called me or anyone else she knew by their actual name. I have her white cashmere shawl. I wore it for days after her death. I wrapped myself up in it. I even slept in it. But now I can't bear to wear it because it feels as if that's all there is left of my Judy. I want to talk to her. I want to have lunch with her. I want her to give me a book she just read and loved. She's my phantom limb, and I can't believe I'm here without her. A few months before they found the lump on her tongue, Judy and I went out to lunch to celebrate a friend's birthday. It had been a difficult year. Barely a week had passed without some terrible news about someone's health. I said at lunch, "What are we going to do about this? Shouldn't we talk about this? This is what our lives have become. Death is everywhere. How do we deal with it?" Our birthday friend said, "Oh, please, let's not be morbid." Yes, let's not be morbid. Let's not. On the other hand, I meant to have a conversation with Judy about death before either of us was sick or dying. I meant to have one of those straightforward conversations where you discuss what you want in the eventuality. Well, I say the eventuality, but that's one of the oddest things about this whole subject. Death doesn't feel eventual or inevitable. It still feels avoidable somehow, but it's not. We know in one part of our brains that we are all going to die, but on some level we don't quite believe it. But I meant to have that conversation with Judy so that when the inevitable happened, we would know what our intentions were, so that we could help each other die in whatever way we wanted to die. But of course, once they found the lump, there was no having the conversation. Living wills are much easier to draft when you are living instead of possibly dying. They're the ultimate hypotheticals. And what difference would it have made if we'd had that conversation? Before you get sick, you have absolutely no idea how you're going to feel once you do. You can imagine you'll be brave, but it's just as possible you'll be terrified. You can hope that you'll find a way to accept death, but you could just as easily end up raging against it. You have no idea what your particular prognosis is going to be, or how you'll react to it, or what options you'll have. You have no clue whether you will ever even know the truth about your prognosis, because the real question is, what is the truth, and who is going to tell it to us? And are we even going to want to hear it? My friend Henry died a few months ago. He was what we refer to as one of the lucky ones. He died at 82, having lived a full, rich, and successful life. He had coped brilliantly with macular degeneration. For almost 2 years, most of his friends had no idea he couldn't see. And then he wrote a book about going blind that will probably outlast all the rest of his accomplishments, which were considerable. He died of heart failure, peacefully, in his sleep, with his adoring family around him. The day before his death, he asked to be brought a large brown accordion folder he kept in his office. In it were love letters he had received when he was younger. He sent them back to the women who'd written them, wrote them all lovely notes, and destroyed the rest. What's more, he left complete, detailed instructions for his funeral, including the music he wanted, all of this laid out explicitly in a file on his computer he called Exit. I so admire Henry and the way he handled his death. It's inspirational. And yet I can't quite figure out how any of it applies. For one thing, I have managed to lose all my love letters, not that there were that many. And if I ever found them and sent them back to the men who wrote them to me, I promise you they would be completely mystified. I haven't heard from any of these men in years, and on the evidence, they all seem to have done an extremely good job of getting over me. As for instructions for my funeral, I suppose I could come up with a few. For example, if there's a reception afterwards, I know what sort of food I would like served. Those little finger sandwiches from this place on Lexington Avenue called William Pole. And champagne would be nice. I love champagne. It's so festive. But otherwise, I don't have a clue. I haven't even figured out whether I want to be buried or cremated, largely because I've always worried that cremation in some way lowers your chance of being reincarnated, if there is such a thing, which I know there isn't, and yet. "I don't want to die," Judy said. I believe in miracles, she said. I love you, she said. Can you believe this, she said. No, I can't believe it. I still can't believe it. But let's not be morbid. Let's put smiley faces on our faces. L-O-L. Eat, drink, and be merry. Seize the day. Life goes on. It could be worse. And the ever-popular, consider the alternative. And meanwhile, here we are. What is to be done? I don't know. I hope that's clear. In a few minutes, I will be through with writing this piece, and I will go back to life itself. Squirrels have made a hole in the roof, and we don't know quite what to do about it. Soon it will rain. We should probably take the cushions inside. I need more bath oil. And that reminds me to say something about bath oil. I use this bath oil I happen to love. It's called Dr. Hoschka's Lemon Bath. It costs about $20 a bottle, which is enough for about 2 weeks of baths if you follow the instructions. The instructions say one capful per bath. But a capful gets you nowhere. A capful is not enough. I have known this for a long time. But if the events of the last few years have taught me anything, it's that I'm going to feel like an idiot if I die tomorrow and I skimped on bath oil today. So I use quite a lot of bath oil, more than you could ever imagine. After I take a bath, my bathtub is as dangerous as an oil slick. But thanks to the bath oil, I'm as smooth as silk. I'm going out to buy more right now.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of I Feel Bad About My Neck and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman by Nora Ephron. This program was produced and directed by Gabrielle DeCure, executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2006 by Nora Ephron. Production copyright 2006, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.